This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
The state, racism, and matters of black life.
We're joined by Glenn Ford, executive editor of Black Agenda Report. Ford has been a journalist and political activist, a provider of information for liberation, as he puts it, for over 40 years. And Tim Wise is one of the country's leading anti-racist writers and activists who lectures on issues of comparative racism, race in education, and racism in the labor market. Wise is the author of 6 books, including Dear White America, Letter to a New Minority. His forthcoming book, The Culture of Cruelty, How America's Elite Demonize the Poor, Valorize the Rich, and Jeopardize the Future, is due when, Tim?
Next couple of months.
Great. Glenn, is Ferguson the spark that embarks this country on a new human rights, democratic rights movement?
It is a movement that is going somewhere. I don't know if it's going in exactly the direction that you just outlined, but it has crossed a kind of Rubicon, and there is no turning back, and the political scene has been changed, and power has been threatened, and not just the power that be in the larger society, but the power structures that exist within black America. These internal power relationships are being shaken. And I think that is probably the most important aspect of the movement to date.
And Tim, I still always think the question, what is it that whites don't get? Why are the exposés of this rash of police killings of black men still so outside of the understanding and concern of the overall white populace?
The historical understanding of white America when it comes to the oppression of black and brown bodies by the state, and particularly by law enforcement, is a very minimal one. I mean, we have this sort of, you know, existential understanding of it, I suppose, if we paid even the remotest attention in high school history. But for the most part, the vast majority of white Americans have absolutely no idea how black and brown folks experience this country. So I was just going through old video clips, and I stumbled across a clip from a Black Power mixtape documentary that came out a couple of years back. And there's a long segment in there with Angela Davis where she's talking about being interviewed by this film crew from, I don't know if it was a Dutch crew or whatever it was that was doing this documentary, but they were asking her, you know, about Black Panthers and support for violence. And she sort of looked at them incredulous, you know, it was quite beautiful. And she said, you know, and I'm paraphrasing her here, but she basically said, you know, whenever I'm asked about nonviolence and about, you know, black people using violence, it just strikes me that the person asking that question knows absolutely nothing about the black experience in America, or you wouldn't ask that question of us about being violent or nonviolent if you really understood the history of violence, which has greeted us, meaning in this case black folks, ever since the first black body came to this shore. And so in a sense, I think part of the blame obviously lies with an educational system that has no interest in telling the truth. It also lies with a political system run by two parties, neither of which have an interest in telling the truth. And I think that it is akin to that movie The Matrix, where, you know, white America has the luxury of taking the blue pill and is in fact subsidized to take the blue pill, to walk around this world with a blue pill IV drip in our veins and not know what's going on, whereas for people of color, at least some, obviously not all for sure, the red pill is a necessity just to understand what's going on in the world. So I think white ignorance is very much subsidized and paid for by the system, sadly, as I think Glenn would probably also agree, and as he has written about and Black Agenda Report has written about so brilliantly. There are also a lot of black and brown folk who have been paid to take the blue pill, so to speak, and to go back to sleep. And what's beautiful about this movement, and you have a lot of young black and brown folk who are breaking with any sense of this sort of old school respectability politics about, oh, this is what we're supposed to say, and we have to kiss this person's butt, and we have to sort of pay homage to this leader and that leader. And they're really saying enough of all that. Our lives are on the line, and by God, we're going to stand up, and we're going to demand justice, and we're going to demand it now. And we're not just going to expect it, you know, at the ballot box. So it's a beautiful movement that's emerging right now.
and Glenn Ford. So Ferguson, the struggle, has already altered black politics. Is that your position and thinking as well?
Oh, yeah. We can't separate this, put it in perspective, without talking about the age of Obama and what the neutralization of black politics since 2008 has actually meant, since the middle of the 20th century. We saw that there could be no vital, vibrant, progressive movement in the United States unless black folks, who historically have been the most progressive-minded ethnic group in the country, unless black folks were deeply involved or in the lead. And so with the election of President Obama in 2008 and this delirium that somehow things had been overcome, we saw a kind of neutralization, a further neutralization of black American politics. And it appeared that we were going to complete the 8 years of President Obama's tenure and would end it in what I was predicting would be the great hangover, which would be equally debilitating to black politics as the great delirium of 2008. But with this movement seeming to take hold in the consciousness of people and this challenge to those forces in black America that have aligned themselves with power, we see the possibility of the age of Obama ending not in a great debilitating hangover, but with the people in motion and ready to challenge the next president, who will be white.
And Glenn, what was it about Ferguson that brought this movement alive? There have been police killings of African-Americans for years, unfortunately, but something different happened in Ferguson. What was it?
They would not leave the streets. They refused to give up the streets of what they considered to be their town, despite the militarized theatrics and intimidation and rubber bullets of the police, and just as importantly, despite the urging of the local elements of the black misleadership class that they find other more peaceful and dignified and sophisticated ways to register their discontent. They refused. They stayed in the streets. They defied the authority of the state, of the police, and they defied the influence of their local black misleadership class figures.
And Tim Wise, is there a distinction that you see in what is happening now from the civil rights movement or the seemingly more militant or more confrontational directly with the entirety of the state? The civil rights movement certainly broke the back of the apartheid style Jim Crow movement of the South, but the Black Power movement did challenge the role of the state more directly and reaped the wrath of the state as well. Do you see some equivalent of what is kind of percolating up, what is burgeoning up at this point from Ferguson forward?
I don't think there's any doubt that much of what we saw in terms of the way the state responded to the Black Power movement in the late 60s and early 70s, we're seeing again. I mean, history is not that unique. And so we're seeing many of the same tactics. We're seeing law enforcement infiltrate peaceful protest and attempt to agitate and actually provoke violence. We certainly saw that in the Bay Area. We've seen it elsewhere. This is one of those areas where I think younger activists and older, more seasoned activists really can help one another. I think the younger activists, on the one hand, have really pointed the way for many of us who've been at the work for a longer period of time. They are incredibly courageous. And to me, you know, they're the people of the year. I know Time does this, you know, person of the year thing. To me, these young activists who have been so incredibly fearless, I mean, think about what they've done. They've gone into places, the Symphony in St. Louis, for God's sake. I mean, I can't imagine a whiter place than that. And they go in and they create a ruckus and they actually get applause from some of the musicians not from the white patrons of the symphony, but from some of the musicians. They go out to the St. Louis Cardinals baseball stadium during the playoffs when they were playing the Dodgers, and they know that there's, what, 20 of them, and they're going to be surrounded by hundreds of drunk white baseball fans who are going to scream at them, but they did it anyway. So on the one hand, those of us who are a little bit older and learn something about courage from these young people, but then the young folks also can potentially learn something from the rest of us about being cautious, because not everybody who says they're down with your movement is down with your movement. There are a lot of folks who have been placed into these marches who were actual cops and law enforcement. I would obviously be silly not to believe that some were federal law enforcement as well. We certainly know the history of that. So I think some historical grounding for the younger folks is something that we can provide. But we need to also be ready to take some direction from these younger people. So a lot of history is repeating itself, but we can be there on the ground to help some of these young folks who have so much courage and so much insight and so much tactical brilliance. I mean, some of the things they're doing. I'm very cynical about internet-based, social media-based organizing. I still think the best organizing is face-to-face, hand-to-hand, door-to-door. But at the same time, I cannot dismiss, and I don't think any of us should, the way that these young people have utilized social media and new technology and digital forms of organizing to spontaneously, it seems, get people all around the country engaged in similar activity. We ought to be, I'm in awe of these young people, and we should be following their lead at the same time, offering them whatever insights we can about the way the state responds, because they may or may not have that historical perspective. We can offer them that even as they offer us the path to real freedom.
One of my earlier conversations with Professor Gerald Horn conjured up again the idea of in 1951 when people went to the United Nations with a We Charge Genocide platform that, of course, took into account the full systemic abuses. There were the manifestations of the economic depression that took the form of police violence, etc. And I'm just wondering about, Glenn, when you you have a piece, when the system provides no remedies to torture, you must overthrow it. And I wonder if you can kind of take us through some of your thoughts about both We Charge a Genocide, the full complement of issues, the systemic nature of racism within our society, or racism as the ideological justification for the structure of racial violence and oppression. And is that where it's at, that we do a full-fledged assault on and make the goal of the new movement the system? Is that what people have to understand?
The movement is arrayed against the system in the most profound of ways, in that it is locked in struggle with the police, the coercive arm of the state. It's difficult to imagine a more direct confrontation than that. Regarding the use of internationalist tactics, I wrote that piece after coming back from a session of the United Nations Committee Against Torture and Cruel and Unusual Punishment. And at that meeting in Geneva, Switzerland, there was a delegation, about 10 young people from Chicago, whose group was called We Charge Genocide. And they clearly were inspired both by Malcolm's urging that people take the Black American case to an international forum, and by the 1951 petition circulated by Paul Robeson, among others, charging the United States with genocide. They had a tremendous impact on the experts who issue these reports regarding the United States and other member states to the Treaty Against Torture's actual performance. It really did influence their behavior, and I think the documents that came out of that session. But just as importantly, I think those young activists, and they all were in their late teens and early 20s, who stood silently in front of the high-powered U.S. delegation from Homeland Security and the State Department and other U.S. agencies, stood for half an hour with silently with their fists in the air, looking like Mexico City 1968, and knowing that they looked like Mexico City in 68. We see that this cadre of young people are subconsciously looking to history as well as the facts on the ground as they lay today for guidance. And we'll see what kind of leadership and direction we get in the course of struggle, because that's where leaders come from. This movement doesn't have a name yet because it has not gelled yet. But objectively, they are confronting the state. They are walking through a central door, not a side door.
Tim, the movement in New York has had a significant number of whites joining with African Americans, but not enough. And I don't know that the whites who even there see this as a systematic attack historically against African Americans. What do we do to increase the numbers of whites who are in the movement and their enlightenment as to the systematic attacks that have occurred for many, many years?
You know, it's a tricky question because on the one hand, I mean, sure, we would love to have, I think all of us would love to have the movement be as broad-based and representative as possible of folks from all racial and ethnic backgrounds. At the same time, though, I think we also know, you know, those of us who've been at this work for a minute, that too many white folks involved in the street actions and the protests can occasionally also create more problems than it solves. I mean, it's nice to have white folks there, certainly to stand between, for instance, the cops and the cadre of color who are really the core of the organizing groups in city after city. And it's valuable to have white folks there as witnesses and to show solidarity. But what we've also seen, let's be honest, around the country is that sometimes the white activists who consider themselves quite radical, and I suppose some of them are in the noblest sense of that word. Others are more radical in terms of their style more than substance, are much more interested in just telling black and brown folks who were leading the movement what the proper way to demonstrate is. Now, that hasn't been the norm. I don't want to suggest that that's the typical thing, but there have been, you know, certainly reports of that around the country. So what I think we want to do is we want to make sure that white folks are engaged in learning from the people of color in their local community who are out there really taking the biggest risk on these issues, learning about their stories, learning about the local context, because every city is going to be a little different. You know, the Bay Area experience for black and brown folks is going to be similar to the New York experience, but it's going to also have some different permutations. The experience here in a place like Nashville or the experience in Atlanta or Miami or Dallas or Chicago, there are going to be some similarities. There are also going to be some very specific things that the white folks in those communities need to understand. And so I think we want white folks to be involved. It's sort of the way I felt after Katrina, you know, everyone was saying, well, how can we get white folks to go to New Orleans and work to not only rebuild, but to help build a movement? And I kept part of me that said, yeah, you know, we want that. And then there was part of me that said, well, we only want that if the white folks are really willing to go and not just put themselves out there. Because sometimes, you know, I've fallen prey to it. I know other white activists have fallen prey to it. Being involved in protest activity can be very exciting, it can be very exhilarating, and God knows it's necessary, and we got to be out there doing it. But it can also sometimes be a thing that is all about me going out there and doing it, not necessarily listening to you. And so if there's going to be white activism and white folks engaged in solidarity, we just want to make sure we're listening to the leadership of color, that we're following their lead, that we're listening to what they need us to do as a matter of accountability. And I think if we're doing that, then white folks can play a very significant role. But I don't just want us to show up and then think that we're going to be the ones who are sort of running things or getting in front of the microphone or, you know, leading the march or leading the rally. Our bodies need to be there, but also our ears need to be there, listening to leadership of color telling us what they need us to do if we're serious about allyship.
Clearly, historically, one of the Achilles heels of the white progressive movement has been its failure to internalize and to understand the issue of self-determination of the African-American communities in how they see proceeding strategically and tactically. I also want to raise something that you had mentioned, Glenn, when you talk about the misleadership class. One of the groups that you took aim at was the Congressional Black Caucus, and I want you to explain why you do not see them as someone to ally with, but have been enormously critical of, and why you think it's so important to be critical of groups such as your writ with a big and a small D, really, Democratic Party politics or politicians.
The Congressional Black Caucus, of course, is just part of that black misleadership class, which consists of black elected officials, almost all Democrats, but also traditional black organizations, black folks in media, in corporations, throughout society. The Congressional Black Caucus back in June, the whole of the Congress, got a chance to have some say about the militarization of police when a bill was put forward that would have stopped the Pentagon's transfers of millions of dollars in weapons and military gear and such to local and state police departments. As a body, the 40 voting members of the Congressional Black Caucus voted overwhelmingly to continue the Pentagon's transfers of weapons to the local police. 27 of them voted down an amendment that would have stopped those transfers, and 5 abstained. That's 32. That's 32 out of 40. 80% of the Congressional Black Caucus was in favor of militarization. They didn't know that only weeks later, in August, Ferguson would happen and militarization of the police would become a national and international subject of controversy. But when they thought that they were voting in the dark, they sided with the militarization of police. People forget that back in 1986, half of the Congressional Black Caucus voted for the 100-to-1 ratio of penalties for crack cocaine versus the powdered kind. None of them will tell you about their record in that regard. The truth is this black misleadership class has collaborated at every level for the last 40 years in the construction of this black mass incarceration regime that has now been in place for two generations and which yields up routinely, consistently, like clockwork, the deaths of Michael Brown's and Eric Garner's and such. They are complicit in the crimes that are institutionally committed against their own constituents. And of course they have to be confronted. They are the enemy within. They are the forces internally that hold back black aspirations to self-determination. Self-determination meaning essentially get off my back. These black misleadership class operatives are the conduits of corporate and white power in black America. So there's no way to avoid coming into confrontation with them.
Now, Tim, you talked about the activists, people of goodwill, who already have some level of consciousness but may not be fully enculturated with the reality of the imperative for self-determination, etc., and not fully clear about how to what depth we internalized racist culture, behavior, and so on. What then about the enormous numbers of liberals and the working class that perpetuates and extends, and certainly one can see that around the recent death of the two police officers in New York, the huge numbers of people that are virtually standing with what is, one might say, a neo-fascist grouping within the city. What do you think needs to be brought forward as part of a movement around white racism, white supremacy?
One of the things that we really want to talk about, and I haven't heard it talked about too much so far within the movement, we really need to have a conversation about the way that the state has consistently done something that's very pernicious, and that is to use a disproportionate number of white working class folks as the shock troops for elites. And if you look at the history of law enforcement historically, going all the way back to the time of slave patrols, what was law enforcement? Law enforcement was what the elite did, hiring working class and economically marginal European-descended people to control black people and to control indigenous people and later to control Mexican-American folk. And it was a great trick, and it was part of what whiteness has always been, right, which is this thing W.E.B. Du Bois talked about, which was creating a psychological wage based in one's skin color as a substitute for real economic empowerment. Obviously, most firefighters, most cops, most construction workers, most working class folks not running the show, not owning the means of production, not in charge of anything. But if you can give them some authority, and if you can give them a badge and a gun, or if you can give them an overseer position on the plantation, or if you can give them a job on the slave patrol, then by God, maybe they'll forget for a minute that you're screwing them too. Maybe they'll forget for a minute that their wages have dropped in real terms over the last 30 years. Maybe they'll forget for a minute that ultimately the economic security that they had expected as part of their civil service job really isn't as secure as they thought. And I think that there is going to come a point, and it's hard, right, because it's very difficult to try to build solidarity with folks who turn their back on a mayor whose only crime in this particular sense, and I'm not saying de Blasio is by any stretch a radical, but his only crime in the eyes of the NYPD is basically what? That he told his son the truth about what it means to be a black male in this country. So it's hard to think about building with folks like that, just like I'm sure it would be hard back in 1970 when the construction workers down at the World Trade Center site, when it was being built, the Twin Towers were being built, you know, beat the hell out of anti-war protesters in 1970, and then were brought to the White House and given, you know, medals of honor for all intent and purpose by President Nixon. I'm sure it's very hard to imagine building with people like that who were so willing to act as the fascist shock troops for the state. But at some point, we are going to have to figure out a way, and I don't claim to know how to do it. I don't even pretend to know how, but we're going to have to really work on that, figuring out how to reach out to these folks who were being used and manipulated, not empowered. I mean, they're being empowered in relative terms by white supremacy, no question about that. They're being empowered in relative terms by their own white privilege, no doubt about that. But in absolute terms, they are being victimized by a system of elite domination that really doesn't give a damn about working class white people, places maybe one or two levels above black and brown folks. And we're going to have to figure out a way to talk to them and to reach them. And that may be the next step down the road. Obviously, the first order of business is protecting black and brown life from those individuals who have willingly chosen to operate as agents of the state. But we are going to have innovation, because there is no way that this change that we need is going to come solely on the back of black and brown radical revolution. It's going to also require that we have some economic analysis to add to that. And so we're going to have to work on that.
Tim Wise, thank you. We eagerly await the book, The Culture of Cruelty, How America's Elite Demonize the Poor, Valorize the Rich, and Jeopardize the Future. And Glenn Ford, executive editor of Black Agenda Report. You got to read it. Glenn Ford, Tim Wise, thank you for joining us. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.